Welcome to the Integrative Ideas in Nutrition podcast. This podcast is produced by the Committee of Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access through the Dietitians in Integrative and Functional Medicine Practice Group with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Join us to explore a range of whole food therapies and mind-body modalities within different settings and cultures, and to celebrate the ways that our diversity in practice and perspective makes us stronger. Please keep in mind that the information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only. I am Sarah Thompson-Fajera, registered dietitian, integrative and functional nutrition certified practitioner, and your host for this podcast. Areli Gutereri is a registered and licensed dietitian who has worked in nutrition and wellness in retail, government, clinical inpatient, and outpatient settings. Areli received her Bachelor's of Science in Nutritional Science from Texas A&M University and her Master's of Science in Nutrition from Texas Women's University. She completed her dietetic internship at Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center in Houston. Currently, she works as a renal dietitian for DaVita Kidney Care, where she has held many additional champion roles. Areli is committed to improving cultural competency, as well as practicing with cultural humility, and discusses this topic with other healthcare professionals on her own podcast, Food Culture Curious, which is well worth a listen. She additionally presented at the 2023 FENSE, the Food and Nutrition Conference and Expo, on cultural inclusivity in the renal diet for Latinos, the very topic that we'll dive into today. Areli has a passion for giving back to her profession, having previously served on the Texas Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics as communication coordinator, a director-elect and director, and is currently serving as nomination chair-elect for Latinos and Hispanics in Nutrition and Dietetics, which is, of course, a practice group within the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. In her free time, she loves Latin dancing, cozy mystery novels, playing with her Labradors, and spending time with friends and family. Lovely, lovely bio. Welcome, Areli. Thanks so much for taking time to be here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this should be really a lot of fun. So I saw that you had presented in 2023, just a few months back at this point. And the title of your session was Beans on the Scene: Adding Latino Foods to the Renal Patient's Diet. And so I thought, gosh, what a perfect person, you know, to come on and talk with us a little bit about culturally competent or sensitive care in the population that you work with, in the renal population, but also would love to hear about your journey to this point. So let's go ahead and start with that. Describe for us a little bit about the journey that you've taken to become the RDN that you are today, some of the influences that have shaped your thinking, and some of the stops along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So Sarah, it's actually very challenging to talk about my journey without having to go a little bit into the difficulties of being first gen. And this is something that I like to talk about, especially with other Latino and Latina students that are struggling to become dietitians, because I think a lot of people are not aware of just how many financial burdens we have to deal with, the language burden. Like, for example, my parents to this day, they still don't, you know, speak English. So trying to navigate FAFSA and scholarships and everything on your own is just such a big challenge. I was aware, you know, early on that we were not going to be in the financial situation for them to pay for me to go to college. So I had to work my butt off in high school, try to get as many scholarships as I could. And even then, I still had to hold multiple part-time jobs in order to finish my bachelor's. And when you're spending so much time working, you don't have the same time to study as other people. So that ended up affecting my GPA, which made getting into internships a lot harder. And then on top of that, your choices are narrowed even more because you can really only pick an internship that's either free or paid or has a stipend, sorry. And those are very few and far between and very competitive, right? Mm-hmm. So my first choice was the VA in Houston. I applied to that as I was graduating, did not get in. Mm-hmm. So I went home, started working for WIC as a nutritionist. Mm-hmm. And back home for me is the Rio Grande Valley. So that's the cities that border Texas and Mexico, right? So I had a very big Hispanic population that I was working with. Mm-hmm. Getting to use those counseling skills was awesome. And I was saving up money thinking, okay, like eventually I'm going to have to move to the city or to Houston to do my internship. So applied again, did not get in. So then I started on my master's thinking, okay, well, I have to consider either finishing my master's first, and I was taking, you know, a couple of classes at a time, working like still full time and going to school. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, okay, I'm either going to have to do my master's first and then get an internship, or maybe I can do the WIC internship. But for that one, you have to work there at least 2 years. So I was just trying to explore all my options. So I applied again. Still didn't get in. But at this point, to wrap up my degree, I moved to Houston to take the classes that were in person. Mm. And I also started working part-time at Jenny Craig, which, you know, we all have our thoughts about diet culture. But as an employer, it was pretty great because they had very flexible hours. Mm-hmm. Since they're open 7 days a week and sometimes till 9 o'clock at night. And that really came in handy when I finally did get in to the VA.
Yes. Yes.
So while I did my internship, thank God, like we had that stipend, but even with that, and even with the student loans, I still had to work every single day of the week. So going months sometimes without having a day off, it's a lot on a person. And towards the end of my internship, I was just having such severe burnout that I started developing severe panic attacks. Mm. And it was something that, you know, at the time, we're talking now, what, 7, 8 years ago, mental health wasn't as talked about as it is now. Mm-hmm. So trying to deal with, you know, the effects of going through this while still working, while doing the internship, it was very hard, and it was affecting my performance at my internship towards the end. Mm. And I eventually had to open up to my director and kind of let her know what was going on. And she was very understanding. She helped me make a transition in my staff relief to a different rotation. Mm-hmm. So just taking some of that pressure off and talking to another dietitian of color that understood what I was going through there at the VA, that really mm-hmm. helped me, just that final push to become a dietitian, mm-hmm. like to just get past that final threshold. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those things, the more I talk to a lot of dietitians, it's just not something that they can relate to, you know, it's something I want internships to be aware of, that I want professors to be aware of when they're, and I had a professor come up to me after when I spoke at FENCE, because I did share a little bit about my journey. And he said, thank you so much for sharing, because I have students that are struggling right now, trying to balance everything, mm-hmm. trying to overcome all these, you know, financial barriers and language barriers and everything. So yep. thank you so much for, you know, showing them that it can be done, that it's mm-hmm. so, so difficult, but it can be done. And I try to go out of my way now as a dietitian to try to yeah. be the best preceptor I absolutely can be. I've been in their shoes.
Yeah,
I don't know what they're going through, but I can imagine because mm-hmm. of what I went through. It really got me to be involved now in La Hidan, because I want there to be people like me helping the next generation, helping Latinos and Latinas that want to be dietitians, trying to give them any information that I can. Mm-hmm. If they reach out to me on Instagram and say, hey, I'm interested in doing dietetics, I'm like, call me. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about what you're going to have to prepare for financially, different internships, different routes you can take. It's very difficult. And a lot of us don't have, unfortunately, like the parental guidance, because we're first gen. You know, we're the first ones to go to college.
Right. So you're navigating the intricacies of the process, not only the dietetic specific process, but federal aid and the financial piece and how does this all work and developing financial literacy and all of that at the same time, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And there's this layer as well when you're in your internship for, I think for everyone, but I think it's unique, right? Person to person, where you're also trying to figure out who your identity is as a professional. Yeah. Where you're hearing things in school or experiencing, whether from your preceptors or from patients or whoever it might be, you're experiencing the impact of other people's preferences or, you know, the way that they're saying things should be done. And so as you are going through that piece of your journey, areas of the internship, curriculum or requirements, did you feel really kind of synced up with your beliefs and values? And, you know, were there already places where you were thinking, like I'm seeing where there's some stereotypes here or some ways of practice that really, I don't actually think are probably ideal, you know, based off your experience with WIC and the populations you had worked with.
If anything, in my internship, I felt like I found out more about the things I didn't like than what I did like, because, you know, CCU, ICU, all of that, it is very hectic. And obviously, you're making a big impact when you're doing, you know, TPN and all of TPNing, all of that. But for a lot of patients that I saw, it just went by so fast that I felt like I wasn't making an impact in the way that I wanted, right? I felt like I just had time to go to the rooms, give them a handout, and hope that they followed up. And that to me just didn't connect with helping someone. And then on the other side, when I was doing outpatient, it wasn't as complex as I was looking for. So the outpatient that I had was a lot of weight loss, a lot of like pre-diabetes, things like that. And after you repeat that over and over and over and over, even within just my internship, I was already getting bored. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I'm not really connecting to these paths, right? But when I graduated, what ended up happening was my first job was as a dietitian for the Department of Public Safety in North Carolina. And so that is the prison system, right? So, yes.
Interesting. And
yes. I actually learned so much because the way it works over there is that if an offender gets sick, has cancer, needs to be on dialysis, they don't get sent out to the hospital. The state of North Carolina has the state prison with its own hospital. And that's where all the doctors, all everything is, mental health, everything is there. So it's this huge building. And then each floor is, you know, a different level of acuity. We have our own we had our own dialysis unit. No longer there, so I can't say we at the time.
Sure.
There's a dialysis unit there. There's, you know, everything there. So I became a dietitian for that system, and there's only two dietitians for the entire building. So we are doing everything. I saw everything you can think of, every comorbidity, a lot of, you know, gunshot wounds and fights and wound healing, like a lot of mental health issues. So I think that's where I got the most and quickest exposure to like different ways to use or different ways that dietitians are involved in nutrition care.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. And one of the things that I got exposed to there was dialysis, right? And I really liked that dialysis was so lab heavy and so intricate. Like, it's just a big puzzle as far as how all the nutrients work together, how the medications affect the nutrients. And yeah, it's not as fast paced as ICU or CCU. Like, you still see the same patients all the time. You get to build that rapport and build those counseling skills. But it's never boring.
So even there, when you were, you know, in that position, you felt like you were developing relationships with your patients, or you were able to make contact with them more than once. And that was part of what you really liked. Yeah.
Exactly. You could follow up and see the fruits of your labor.
And create interventions based off of the laboratory values. It sounds like that's something else you enjoyed. It's like, okay, here's this value, I do this, and then I see a change, which is really rewarding.
Yes.
Yeah, to see that kind of quantitative outcome there. Okay, so you were introduced to dialysis at that point. So talk to us about a little bit, just to backtrack a little bit, about your own kind of food culture upbringing. Bring us back there if you could.
Sure. My parents are from Mexico. I was born and raised here, so I'm Mexican American. But as I mentioned, I grew up on the border. So 95 probably percent of the population in the valley is Hispanic. So I mostly grew up eating Mexican food, you know. And when it came to counseling the WIC population, or even now with my Hispanic dialysis population, it's a blessing to be able to understand the types of foods that they're working with and be able to accommodate the nutrition recommendations to include those foods. Because one thing that I find, especially now in the dialysis world, is that everyone just keeps getting these lists. Like, it's very black and white of like, okay, these are the foods you can't have, and these are the foods you can't have. And whether that's, you know, diabetes or dialysis, or we have just these lists, right? And they don't, that's lazy education to me, because it's so nuanced. You can't just tell a diabetic, and you know, you hear that a lot from your patients. Oh, I have diabetes. I was told I couldn't have white rice. I have diabetes. I was told I couldn't eat tortillas. I was told that I couldn't have corn and I couldn't have this. And so they're excluding and excluding and excluding all these cultural foods. And that goes double in dialysis, because now we're taking into account phosphorus and potassium, and they're getting these lists saying, oh, beans are high in phosphorus, you can't have them. Nuts are high in phosphorus, you can have them. Tomatoes, avocados, mangoes, those are high in potassium, you can't have them. So if they're going off of that black and white thinking, it's impossible, right? It's impossible to embrace your cultural foods and follow this restrictive diet.
And so I want to talk about how you've adapted your counseling and things, but what do you think has been the impact on your patients of some of those lists? Like, when you start to work with someone who has a background eating some of those foods and they have just heard, no, how are they approaching food at that point in time? Or what has been the mental health impact for them?
No, exactly. So what I find happens to a lot of my patients is that they just feel there's a loss of morale, right?
Yeah.
And they feel like, I should just give up. What's the point? Like, what's the point? If this means that I can't have my favorite food, then why do it? You know, and that's where you get into this mentality, or at least this is what I hear a lot from, you know, patients that are coming to me thinking that they have to follow this type of diet, is that, you know what, I'm going to die of something eventually, I might as well die of this. Like, they just give up. Or on the other side of that, if I do have patients that want to follow what they've heard up until this point, then they're sad because they've gone so long without their favorite food. I had one patient tell me before he came to my clinic that he had been told, no, he couldn't have beans. So he hadn't had beans in 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, that's something, at least as the Mexican-American, like, we eat almost every day. I can't imagine not having your cultural foods for years.
What are some of the other challenges that you see with just Latino patients in general, with various stages of chronic kidney disease, just across the board when it comes to nutritional management?
Yeah, so one big barrier is, of course, the language. There's very few, as it is, there's very few Latino dietitians to begin with, right? Only 6% of dietitians are Latino or Latina. And then even less dialysis dietitians or renal dietitians in general. And think of how many patients on dialysis or with CKD are Hispanic and Spanish speaking.
Yeah.
And just that language barrier alone really keeps them from being able to understand the regimen and like what's being asked of them. So I've had patients where I arrive, right? I started at a new clinic and I meet patients that speak Spanish and they just like, light up and they just seem so relieved. Like, oh my gosh, I can finally ask questions.
Oh yeah.
Like I can finally, you know, like, what does it mean? Like the nutrition, like, well, what does this mean? Or, okay, so how can I help my counseling? Like they have all these questions that they haven't been able to get answered up until this point.
Wow.
So yeah, that language barrier is a big deal. And even being able to get into motivational interviewing, because it's one thing, you know, when you have a patient that doesn't share your language, your resources are limited. Sometimes you get to use a translation line. Sometimes that's not feasible, especially because a translator doesn't understand the science that you're trying to convey, right? They sure. can't really explain starches and carbohydrates. Like that's just probably not in their, you know, that medical definition is probably not in their usual vocabulary.
Right, sure. They might not understand the intricacies maybe of how to communicate the nutrition info. Yeah.
So we use what we have when we don't share that language. We use handouts, right? But that doesn't give you the ability to go into what's really going on. And that motivational interviewing is so important in any type of dietetics education, any type of nutrition education, but especially in dialysis, because they're dealing with so much. They're trying to balance so much. It's a lot of them start to, you know, get burnt out. They start to give up. And so you need to find ways to keep them engaged. And you need to be able to speak the same language to be able to really do that well.
You can just probably hear concerns in a much different way or understand, kind of gets the heart of the matter more directly and more quickly, right? When you speak the same language, you know, the translator lines are a beautiful thing, but I can imagine it's just so different. So different when you're sharing a language. So language barrier, huge, and that can impact their comprehension, their ability to ask questions. What other unique challenges have you seen in, you know, Hispanic or Latino population around nutritional management of CKD? Anything else that comes to mind?
One that's important to talk about is, again, that financial barrier for these patients, because sometimes if they're not residents, they can't get insurance, right? They're paying everything out of pocket. Or maybe just their insurance doesn't, they can't afford a very good one. And their insurance doesn't cover these very expensive medications. And when you're on dialysis, usually you're on a lot of different medications. You're on medications trying to control your blood pressure, trying to control your potassium, trying to control your phosphorus, trying to control your diabetes. If you a lot of patients on you know, dialysis have diabetes, and to be able to afford all of that on such a limited income, which happens a lot in my Hispanic population, that's a big barrier. And being able to help them get those resources, I usually partner up with the social worker. But I made a point, at least especially in the aspects of like phosphorus and potassium where I'm involved heavily, to learn as much as I can about the resources out there to help them get these binders. So whether that's patient assistance programs or making sure the, you know, prior authorizations are getting done, or trying to explain to them what a medical exemption is, like it's very difficult to navigate all of these programs, especially if they're Spanish speakers and they don't even, you know, they can't even really read the forms that explain the program to you. So helping them get through those hardships, that's another big challenge.
So when you're meeting with a patient for the first time, and you know that they have a food background that you're trying to honor and respect and incorporate into the counseling relationship, how do you conceptualize the translation of those food or, you know, food and cultural practices into clinical care? And can you walk us through what a process looks like, you know, with one of those patients?
Whether they're, you know, whether a new patient or not, I always check for their understanding first, right? Before I do any education. I check to see like, okay, what are your ideas? Especially everything's very lab heavy, right? So if I'm seeing they have this really high phosphorus, I'll check for, okay, tell me a little bit about phosphorus. What do you understand about it before, you know, we dive into it? And just to see, some of them have been on dialysis for 10 years and they can tell you all about phosphorus, right? And how it affects the body and the different reasons that we want to keep it at a safe level. the checking for understanding after that, making sure that they know about the, you know, the different types of phosphorus and how they're absorbed, what foods that we're going to include more often, right? The ones that are lower in phosphorus, we're going to do more often, and how to pair that with when they want a higher phosphorus food, or how to portion a higher phosphorus food, how to change the cooking methods to be able to incorporate a higher phosphorus food. For example, a lot of people worry about beans, and that's why it was like the main food that we focused on for our presentation. So a lot of people worry, oh, you know, beans are so high in phosphorus or so high in potassium. Okay, but if you leach them, you can get some of that potassium up, right? If you have half a cup, or if you want monitor the portion, it's actually a lower phosphorus portion. It's not that black or white thinking. And that's what takes a lot of education to, you know, to explain, because especially patients who aren't familiar with this concept, at first they might get overwhelmed, you know, because it's so much easier. They sometimes patients want, just tell me what I can have and what I can't have. And I try to explain to them, it's not about this food is safe, this food is not. It's about the portions and how they all combine together. Just like in most other disease states, right? Just like in diabetes, it's not like bread is bad. It's not rice is bad. It's what are you pairing with? How much are you having to keep those blood sugars safe? Same thing for phosphorus, same thing for potassium.
So you're helping them to understand the nuances and, you know, how to pair things together and all of that. So what are some of the foods that you find yourself talking about most often? It sounds like beans, that's one group, or legumes. Mm-hmm. What other foods are you successfully incorporating into your patients' diets where you feel like there's a really nice outcome from that?
Yeah, other common ones I would probably say would be potatoes, right? Another food that gets a bad reputation of being high potassium, that they can't have it. So teaching them about how to incorporate and leach potatoes. Tomatoes is another big one that gets a really bad reputation. I try to explain to them, okay, it's not the same thing having one slice of tomato on your burger versus having a cup of salsa with chips, right? It's going to be a different amount of concentration, different amount of potassium. So you tell me what meal you're trying to make, and I can tell you how to incorporate that tomato into it, right? You want to talk about creating a salad, we can do that. You want to talk about having some pico de gallo on your tacos, we can do that. Or you do want to add a little bit of salsa to your foods, we can talk about that. It's just going to be a difference in portion, and sometimes we're going to have to decide what's more important, right? If it's starting to become a higher potassium meal because it includes avocados and tomatoes and potatoes and, you know, just a lot, we might have to reduce the portion of all of them, or you might have to pick two out of three so that we can keep it in a safe level. But I don't want you to ever feel like you can't have it. Let's just work on it, you know, together.
Oh, I really love that. Yeah, I really love that. Give me an example of a recipe. You're doing like the recipe makeover with them. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that was something, in fact, this past week, I had my intern create a board to explain to the patients about, like, okay, these are your higher phosphorus foods, these are your lower phosphorus foods, this is how we can pair them together. These are some examples of how we can pair them so that we can create a balanced meal that's not too high in phosphorus. So things like that are good resources for them. I think another one that I really like to talk about is avocado, because avocado is pretty high in potassium. So there's a video that I use with the permission of my friend, Maria Eugenia. She's also a renal dietitian, and she created a video on, I think it's Instagram, where she shows the different portions of avocado and how, like, this much potassium is in this portion versus this portion versus this portion. And I help them see, you know, the visual of, like, the different portions and how much potassium they have. And I think those resources are really needed. So I'm super happy that, you know, she also works on creating those. And sometimes you don't need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But talking about those foods with them, that really helps with their stress around being able to eat these foods and enjoy them and still, you know, embrace their cultural foods, but be able to have safe levels of phosphorus and potassium.
Yeah. Are there other visual tools that you like, whether plates or, so you mentioned a video just now, anything else you use in your day-to-day counseling sessions that comes to mind?
Well, in my day-to-day, in a dialysis center, you're usually rounding on the floor, right?
Yeah,
all the chairs are right next to each other and you go talk to them. Things that I've brought before is examples of products. And I show them how to find those phosphorus additives and those potassium additives in the food label. Just to give a little background in case this is a student that's like, what are you talking about? That's listening to this podcast. So for phosphorus and for potassium, they are absorbed at different rates depending on where it's coming from, right? So if it's coming from a plant-based source, that phosphorus, that potassium isn't very well absorbed. Versus if it's coming from an animal, it's absorbed a little bit more as far as the phosphorus. And then if it's coming from chemicals that are added to foods to help with the freshness or emulsification or a thousand different reasons a food company can use a potassium or phosphorus additive, those additives are absorbed 90 to 100%. Even if they're on binders, it can't really stop just how well absorbed it is. So in order to be able to find those potassium and phosphorus additives, you're not really going to see it on the nutrition label, not the top part. You're going to only find it in the ingredients. So I walk around with like products that do or don't have these additives. And I ask them, okay, can you find the additive? So then what do you think? Like, is this a low phosphorus food or a high phosphorus?
Are there any specific products that have caught you off guard or that have surprised you that have some of those additives in them that are really commonly consumed in the population you work with?
It's hard because it's everywhere. It's brand to brand.
Brand to brand,
it's not even the product itself. It's the brand. It's the food manufacturer.
How they produce it. Yeah.
So to give you an example, for Mexican hot chocolate, and I talk about this in my presentation, in Mexican hot chocolate, there's two very popular brands, which is the Abuelita brand and then the Chocolate Ibarra brand. But if you put the ingredients next to each other, the Abuelita brand has phosphorus and potassium additives, but the Chocolate Ibarra does not. So both of these are Mexican hot chocolate. You can, you know, obviously you still want to be careful with your portion, but one of them is going to have more phosphorus and potassium than the other one.
Wow. Yeah. That's a really good example. The power of label reading. Yes. Knowledge for sure. Okay. So in terms of benefits of incorporation, when those that you're working with realize that they can incorporate some of their favorite foods, what do you think the benefits are for those individuals? How does it change their relationship with food or nutrition or their health?
A lot of relief, because it is a lot to have to deny your own culture and deny your own identity. And the patient is thinking, I'm doing this for my health, but it affects them. So to be able to be reunited with these foods, it's very important to them, and sometimes makes it feel more doable for them. So they don't have to think it's something they have to live without. And they're like, okay, I can do this. If I just have to learn about absorption or learn about portions, that's more doable than like never having it again. And tossing it all out the window.
Yeah. So I can imagine that it probably changes the dynamics even within families too, with family meals and being with community and being able to participate.
I don't want them to have to make separate meals, especially during special occasions. We don't want them to feel like they're other or not part of the celebration. So we do talk to them, especially in the holiday season. Okay, tell me about the kind of foods that you usually have during this meal, like your Christmas dinner, whatever that may be. Tell me about what foods and sides and garnishes you typically use. Let's see if we can find a way to include that one thing you really love that might be higher phosphorus, higher potassium, and pair it with those lower phosphorus, lower potassium foods. You can still take part in the celebration and you can still eat the same foods. It might just be different portions, but you can still be a part of it. And that's very important to them.
I love that. Okay. So other perspective, words of wisdom.
Yeah. In my podcast, I talk about how important it is as dietitians, not just to always be learning the science behind everything, do a great job of that, right? Getting CEUs and going to conferences and always learning about the newest research, but also always be learning about other cultural foods, because it makes such a big difference to be able to at least know what they're talking about. So whenever possible, try out different cuisines. If you know dietitians of different backgrounds, talk to them about food, because they'll be able to, one, understand the cultural aspect, and they'll also be able to explain it to you in a way that you would understand. Like, you guys can talk about, okay, hey, so I work a lot with the diabetes population. If I really wanted to help my Black population or my Vietnamese population, you know, how would you treat someone of that culture? Like, if I'm talking to my Vietnamese dietitian friend, like, okay, I have a patient with diabetes. What recommendations do you have? Like, what foods should I be aware of? What celebrations should I be aware of? And me having these questions is what led me to creating my podcast. I thought to myself, okay, a dietitian will be able to explain it from both sides, from the nutrition side and from the cultural side. So I think it's the responsibility of us as dietitians to always be learning about these cultural foods and what their role is in nutrition, so that we never have to tell someone, no, you can't have this, or no, you shouldn't have this. Or, I mean, there are times it's going to happen that I don't know what that is. I'm going to have to Google that. But
yeah, sure. Yeah.
But the more familiar you are, the better a dietitian you're going to be.
So it sounds like finding a new restaurant is one strategy to try. And then, just networking and staying connected. And certainly your podcast is a great resource for that, because you're having conversations with other dietitians and kind of diving into, all right, what are the intricacies of these different cultural practices, et cetera. So I encourage people to head over there and take a listen. Any other points of interest to you? Anything else you'd like to bring up before we begin to close?
No, don't be afraid to refer out. Like you mentioned, you know, always network and get to know dietitians of different backgrounds. And if you know that your patient would really benefit of having a dietitian that share that background, that might be able to better help them, don't be afraid to refer out.
You want people to feel like they have the best rapport possible, so they can be served to the highest extent. All right, so let's close it out. Do you have a quote or a poem, something that you'd like to close us with?
So hopefully I remember this correctly. It's a song that's in Spanish and has a part that says, yo te llevo adentro hasta la raíz y por más que crezca vas a estar aquí. And what that means is, I carry you with me down to my roots, and no matter how much I grow, you will always be there. And I feel like our cultural identity, our cultural foods, like, that's just something that we carry us down to our core. And no matter how much we might, you know, grow and evolve as people, that's always going to be a part of us. And so it's very important to embrace and celebrate that.
For more information about evidence-based resources in integrative, holistic, and functional medicine, visit the Dietitians in Integrative and Functional Medicine website at integrativerd.org. If you have enjoyed this episode, subscribe in your favorite podcast app to continue learning about diversity in nutrition practice and perspectives.